Lydia and Jay are not just colleagues, they're friends. You can tell when talking to them that they enjoy each other's company. They've worked together so long that they sometimes finish each other's sentences, but they're polite enough that they usually apologize for doing so. They work together at the EPA facility in Corvallis, Oregon, where they research issues surrounding transgenic crops. The commercial development of these crops is now a robust business. There is transgenic cotton and corn with genes for insect resistance, and soybeans and canola with herbicide resistance. All these products have been on the market for several years now, and commercial research scientists are continuing to introduce all sorts of traits into plants, primarily for agricultural use.
For example, to make plants resistant to certain herbicides, to make plants resistant to certain types of insects.
Some scientists are even working on more specialized traits.
To make plants resistant to things like drought, freezing, salt stress, and also to make plants be able to make unique chemicals, even drugs, pharmaceutical compounds.
The responsibility to regulate GM crops falls to not one, but several federal agencies, depending on what the crop would be used for. If, for example, the crop is to be made resistant to an herbicide, which is sprayed to control weeds, the lead regulatory agency is the Department of Agriculture.
If, on the other hand, the crop has been made resistant to certain types of insects, then the Environmental Protection Agency is the lead agency for commercializing that kind of crop.
And as there's increasing emphasis on producing plants that can make pharmaceutical products, the FDA, or Food and Drug Administration, is also getting involved in the regulation of those plants.
Lately, Lydia and Jay have been focusing their work on the potential for genes introduced into one plant species to move into another species, especially non-crop plants that are closely related to the GM crop. Such movement of genetic traits is called gene flow. An opportunity for real-world testing of gene flow is sometimes difficult to come by because of the potential for pollen drift. But as it happens, in 2003, one such project dropped into Jay and Lydia's laps. That year, a large field trial of GM creeping bentgrass was conducted by Scott Seed Company and Monsanto Company in Central Oregon.
The fields were established under U.S. Department of Agriculture permit. These were experimental fields, 8 experimental fields, were grown by Scotts and an associated company, New Era Seeds, north of Madras, Oregon.
The location was significant. Willamette Valley in western Oregon has ideal conditions for grass, so commercial growers love it there.
Western Oregon's Willamette Valley is the primary production area for grass seed in the country. 70% of the grass seed in the country is grown in western Oregon.
So because of that economic importance, the experimental field trials of GM creeping bentgrass were conducted in central Oregon, just east of the Cascade Mountains. Creeping bentgrass is a wind-pollinated grass developed for use on golf courses. The GM trait expressed by the crop allowed it to be resistant to glyphosate. That's the active ingredient in Roundup herbicide. The GM trait also provided Lydia and Jay a method to track the movement of the GM gene from the test crop to nearby wild grass relatives and sentinel plants. Because of the proximity to Willamette Valley and its commercial grass seed market, numerous conditions were placed on the test plots by both the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Specialized equipment was used for the planting and the harvest. The goal was to reduce the possibility that any of the GM seeds would move from the experimental fields into other areas.
There were dedicated combines, dedicated swathing equipment, designated decontamination procedures for the equipment and for people entering fields or cleaning out batches of seed from one piece of equipment or another.
Also, tight controls were placed on the planting in order to prevent any pollen or seed drift from occurring.
There were 900-foot buffers around the fields. The entire district, or control district as it was called, was an area in which the GM bentgrass could be grown but non-GM bent grass could not be grown. And the local growers went to great lengths to remove areas where there was native either creeping bent grass or a close relative.
In the case of creeping bent grass, those close relatives are called creeping bent grass and red top. These wild cousins to the bent grass played an important role in Lydia and Jay's work. That's because in order to look at the possibility of gene flow, it would be useful if they could find a wild relative growing in the area. Gene flow was not much of a problem for the first transgenic crops commercially available in the United States.
And it so happens that for those particular crops, the corn, the soybeans, and cotton, they do not have compatible relatives in the main growing areas where those are produced, for example, in the Midwest or Southeast.
But for creeping bent grass, it was a different story.
Creeping bent grass, which is a type of grass designed for use on golf courses, happens to have numerous relatives both in the U.S. and throughout the world.
Having that wild cousin nearby meant that a real-world study could be established to look at the possibility of gene flow. In this case, the movement of genes from the transgenic crop into its wild cousins. An important part of the study was the fact that they were able to begin their work at the same time the first transgenic crop fields were allowed to flower.
In approximately 2003 was the first time that almost 400 acres of GM fields of this creeping bent grass grew in central Oregon. This provided us basically a baseline, a time zero, to see where if you were in a location where the crop had never been grown before, it never had produced pollen before.
Before the test actually started, the scientists began their work by developing a couple of different methods to track the possible movement of genes from the transgenic crops. First, they identified the research area they wished to study. That area surrounded the experimental GM bentgrass test plots. Then, they surveyed that area to look for wild creeping bentgrass and its close relative, red top. They identified those locations for later analysis. Next, they deployed something called sentinel plants.
A sentinel plant is somewhat like a canary. You want something that would be sensitive to, or in our case, receptive to, this GM pollen.
The sentinel plants were of the same species as the crop, but they were a non-GM variety of it. So they were perhaps the most compatible type of recipient plant that you could put in the field to potentially catch pollen from the environment.
The sentinel plants were placed into the research area before the actual test got underway.
Individual plants were put in pots, and they were placed in a grid fashion around the bent grass control area.
So now, they had two different methods for identifying potential drift. The wild populations of creeping bent grass and of its relative red top, which they had earlier identified throughout the research area. And they had the sentinel plants. Once all this initial work was complete, they waited. The hope was that if there were pollen from the test plants moving off the testing grounds, the pollen would meet up with the wild populations of bent grass or red top or the sentinel plants arranged in pots throughout the area, and the scientists would later be able to find the GM gene from the test plants in these other related grass species. The area they were working in was very large, and such efforts could certainly be compared to searching for a needle in a very large haystack. A haystack spread out over many acres of canals, ditches, roadsides, and rivers. As the growing season wound to an end, the EPA scientists began collecting samples of seeds from the wild and sentinel plants. Then they checked for the presence of GM genes using a number of methods. They use what they call brute force. They screened more than a million collected seedlings in a greenhouse environment. They grew those seedlings for 2 weeks, then sprayed them with Roundup herbicide. Remember, the transgenic plants had a gene making them resistant to Roundup. So if that live pollen made it to the wild plants or the sentinels, then any resulting seedlings would express that resistance. So over a six-month period, they sprayed more than a million seedlings with Roundup.
And most of the plants would die. I mean, Roundup is a non-selective herbicide that farmers use it, you know, homeowners use it, very widely used. Most of the plants would die. However, if you had some green plants survive in these trays that you had with the seedlings, that then became a what we called a presumptive positive plant.
Even with most of the plants dying, they found that almost 1,000 seedlings had received the GM gene. Then those plants were sprayed once again with Roundup. If they survived the second spraying, they conducted an immunological test on the plants. And if they still showed a positive result, they conducted two different types of DNA testing. All in all, it was a well-documented, thorough, but time-consuming process.
We confirmed our results in four different ways. The first-line way of determining if you had had gene flow was to see if the plants, the seedlings, were resistant to Roundup herbicide. That was a greenhouse spray test. The second was the immunological, or the pregnancy test, as we called it. The third was a type of molecular biology test, the polymerase chain reaction, where you were looking for the specific piece of DNA that gave the plants the ability to produce the protein that made it resistant to the herbicide. And finally, was to sequence that piece of DNA to find out the individual composition of the chemicals that made up that gene.
But in the end, all that work verifying their results, then verifying them once again, resulted in findings that literally changed the predominant view for how far viable pollen might typically be dispersed in the environment.
As a result of those tests that were done 2003 to 2004, we found something that really was very, very novel news to the scientific world, and that is that we tracked the movement of live pollen that carried the GM gene as far as 13 miles. This is much, much longer, much, much wider than the traditional buffers, which may be only tens of feet or maybe hundreds of feet around the field. And this is information that has been of keen interest both to the scientific community and the regulatory community around the world.
These results are significant. Until this study, common belief held that gene flow would not occur much further than perhaps 100 feet or so. And in fact, the 900-foot buffer zone around the test plots was presumed to be more than sufficient to prevent any gene spread.
The surprising aspect of it is how far it occurred. As Lydia indicated before, this really changed the paradigm with which people thought about how far GM pollen could move. And it wasn't just that it was GM pollen. You know, it was convenient for us to be able to track it because it had the GM trait in it. But it demonstrated how far the pollen could move and form hybrids in the wild. And so that gave a lot of people pause and gave them reason to think about, well, are the isolation distances that we're establishing for GM crop fields adequate?
Needless to say, the scientists were somewhat surprised at their findings, at least slightly.
Were we surprised? I think we could say yes and no. Yes, in that generally in the literature, people reported live pollen movement on a scale of meters or yards, perhaps measured in tens or hundreds of either of those units. However, based on two very simple assumptions that went into our sampling design, one, that the prevailing winds were coming out of the north-northwest at roughly 10 kilometers or 6 miles an hour, and based on literature reports that pollen could survive in a petri plate environment in the laboratory for 3 hours if you simply did the arithmetic of 6 miles times 3 hours, you would have predicted that you should sample out to 18 miles or so.
So in the end, they weren't too surprised to find drift occurring so far away. However, they are quick to point out that the vast majority of pollen dispersal and gene flow occurred closer into the test fields that were the source of the pollen.
But just as you might say that most of the apples fall close to a tree, although we did find some that were out to that 13 miles, 70 to 80% of the gene flow from the GM crop to either the sentinels or to the wild relatives occurred within just a few miles of the perimeter of the control district.
The following year, they once again surveyed the wild populations near the test plots. There had been a great deal of discussion over the years about whether transgenic crops could actually become established in the wilds. In other words, documenting the movement of genes through greenhouse and laboratory tests does not necessarily mean that wild plants that receive the GM gene could survive in the wild. So they conducted their survey the next year to see if plants that contain the GM gene did indeed occur in the natural environment.
Through our surveys, we found 55 populations or patches of plants that could hybridize with this GM bentgrass in the non-agricultural or non-agronomic habitat surrounding the control area where the crops were grown. And what we were able to show is that we had plants established up to 3.8 kilometers or roughly a little over 2 miles outside of the control area that were growing within these wild grass populations. The novelty of this is that it's the first example of an escape of genetically modified plants into the wild in the United States. Really what it shows is that if a crop has wild relatives, plants are going to get off the farm. GM plants are going to get off the farm.
Jay says this is a significant finding. This is the first ever documentation in the United States of GM genes that have crossed with wild plants and that have become established in the wild.
Well, it could be important if the GM trait in a wild population has some unanticipated impact on the population. If it either gives those plants some sort of advantage where they were able to survive in the environment and spread more vigorously than the wild plants would. Or it may be the opposite. It may be that by having the GM trait, those plants are actually less fit and the hybrids that are formed are less fit, and it may cause that local population to crash. Or another possibility is that the GM trait in the wild would have no impact. You don't know until you get out there and you study, and you have to consider the environments in which these plants are growing. With the Roundup resistant plants that we found in the wild, we wouldn't necessarily anticipate that those plants would have a fitness advantage, except if they were growing in an area where Roundup was being sprayed. It turns out that this grass happens to really prefer wet habitats. And Roundup happens to be one of the only herbicides that's approved for spray around wet habitats. So if people are spraying to control for weeds in those areas, they might actually select or provide the chance for these plants to grow in number and frequency.
Needless to say, the researchers point out that there are a lot of questions that remain. For instance, these results may not apply to other crops or their wild relatives. While many crops are wind-pollinated, some pollen may be much bigger than that from the creeping bentgrass, and so not move as far. Other plants may not have relatives living nearby, so it would be impossible for cross-pollination to occur. All those questions, and many more like them, mean Lydia and Jay's work will not come to an end anytime soon.
The newer research that we're involved with now involves methods development to determine if, in the event that a gene has moved away from the GM crop to a compatible relative, whether or not that has a good, bad, or neutral effect on the environment.
And that leaves them a whole new world of possibilities. For EPA's Science in Action, I'm Donna Vincent Roa.